Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. As the Sheffield International Documentary Festival gets underway, I speak to filmmaker Jez Lewis. His harrowing portrayal of his idyllic hometown Hebden Bridge in Yorkshire is the subject of Shed Your Tears and Walk Away, screening at the festival this weekend. From north to south, we sent Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps to Qatar, not because we don't like him, but because the inaugural Doha Tribeca Film Festival was underway. We'll be hearing from Jason about the best Middle Eastern and Indian films screened at the first festival. And Zan Brooks is back. This week he and I will be reviewing Jim Carrey in the animated A Christmas Carol, Evil Gets Cute in Jennifer's Body, and from plucked eyebrow to highbrow, we review Jane Campion's Keats biopic starring Ben Whishaw, Bright Star. Indeed, a thing of beauty is a joy forever. It's Film Weekly.
What are we supposed to do? We're born in Hebden Bridge to carry on Hebden Bridge tradition. We take a lot of drugs, drink a lot of alcohol, to grow a lot of cannabis, and to have a jolly good time in these beautiful Pennine Hills.
Yeah, Hebden Bridge is a drug town with a tourist problem, isn't it?
Pithy yet profoundly sad, that's a clip from Jez Lewis's documentary Shed Your Tears and Walk Away, which screens at this year's Sheffield International Documentary Festival. And I'm delighted to say that Jez Lewis joins me in the studio now. Jez, your film plays at the Sheffield International Documentary Festival on Saturday. It's Shed Your Tears and Walk Away, a successful run at the London Film Festival for you before that. It's an extremely moving film to watch. It must have been much more moving, hellish even, to film.
Thanks very much. Yes, it was very difficult to film. In particular, the transitions between being amongst the sadness that was going on and coming back home to my young children feeling distressed was quite difficult. But of course, I was witnessing much, much worse distress amongst the families in Hebden who I was filming with.
So just tell us briefly about the project, set it up for us, how you came to it and what made you decide to kind of delve into this maelstrom.
Sure. Well, I've lost a good few friends to suicide from the town where I grew up. And the only people I've ever known commit suicide have all been from that town. Perhaps the only thing they have in common in terms of their deaths.
And what town is it?
It's called Hebden Bridge and it's in West Yorkshire. It's a beautiful kind of bohemian idyll, but it has remaining population who weren't part of the gentrification.
It looks very lovely. You show it, you kind of have a lovely kind of helicopter shot kind of coming up of it. It looks like something out of All Creatures Great and Small. It's in a ravine, and there's babbling brooks. I mean, what could possibly go wrong in a place like that?
It's hard to say what goes wrong, really. I haven't lived for 20 years in the town, but one sees that there are really two communities. There's a new community who are people who work elsewhere or work from home, and there's the old community whose work just fell away in the post-war and later years.
Your documentary kind of reveals these layers gradually, doesn't it? That the history that you've sort of enumerated there, that it's an ex-mill town, that it became gentrified or hippified, that there are different generations there, different layers of that society. That's not something you lay bare immediately. That's something we get drawn into, isn't it, via your film? Is that the idea?
Yeah, well, the thing that was so key for me was when I first started filming on the park, I said to one of the lads, "Do you mind me filming here?" And he said, "No, of course not. Most people who come here with a camera ask us to get out of the way." And that point, I decided that my job was to give them the camera, if you like, to give them their opportunity to speak, which they wouldn't ordinarily have. And then they talk us through that history gradually as it comes up in conversation.
Now, it's a quaint town. It looks very pretty, as I've said. Just the people in your street that have committed suicide, the number of those is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, when I started off, I didn't know about one or two of them, but a very close friend, Bill, had hanged himself a few years ago. Emma wasn't suicide, but died of a heroin overdose and had a troubled life. My next door neighbour had attempted suicide and been discovered by my mum bleeding to death in the bath. She'd managed to have him resuscitated, but he later died on what is presumed suicide. And, you know, I kind of tried to protect myself emotionally from it. But with Emma, it was sort of the final straw, really.
And that's what made you go back into this and actually kind of deal with it. Why so many people of this, I suppose, generation, your generation, were doing this to themselves?
Yeah, that's right. And Emma was my younger sister's best, closest friend. And our family and her family were almost like cousins, really. So, where I'd had perhaps a bit of distance with some of the others, this felt so much closer to home. And people weren't joining the dots from what I could see. And that, to me, was one of the key elements to it.
It became, I'm not going to say popular, but it became a media sensation, didn't it, when it happened in Bridgend recently. People were blaming Facebook, people were blaming copycat suiciding. There was a kind of mass sort of lemming-like urge to hurl oneself over into the abyss. Did you encounter the same sort of thing in Hebden Bridge? You're saying that no one really cottoned on to the fact that it was happening.
Yeah, it was as if it had become normalised, and part of that is the long timescale over which it had happened, which was, for me, was about 20 years. But when you started to write down the numbers, they added up so high, and Hebden's such a small place that when you do the maths, you see the scale is similar to Bridgend, but it's not the same demographic of all sort of 16 to 25-year-olds over a couple of years. If you expanded the town, you would see something similar.
Looking at the initial kind of the start of your film, it is a load of people drinking special brew in a park, getting stoned, talking about heroin, being kind of ravaged. They're the sort of people you kind of sidestep when you go into a nice picturesque park. Say you're at Hebden Bridge for a bit of a day trip, looking at a beautiful Pennine town. These are the people, as you say, you would avoid. Why should we be interested in their tale?
Well, in particular in Hebden Bridge, it's quite different to that. People are very friendly, and these guys clear up their own litter and they clear up other people's litter, and they're polite and well-mannered. And Hebden Bridge does have that peculiarity of rubbing shoulders. You see in the film, you see the little old ladies eating chips out of chip paper on the next bench to these guys who are hammered because they've been up all night.
Jalkies, I think you call them.
Jalkies is what my principal character Cass, and he's my oldest friend, another reason why I'm obviously not intimidated by that kind of scenario.
There's a sad coda, I believe, also to the film, which you're going to premiere in Sheffield, which wasn't the case when it screened at London. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, well, sadly on Friday, Liam Jones was found dead in the street in Halifax. It's a presumed drug overdose.
This is Liam, whose brother Sam in the film...
Exactly. Sam had died of some mix of alcohol and drugs during the filming, and it's one of the catalysts of the film. And Liam was really, really influential in getting me to keep filming. He asked me to film. He said, look, there's a situation here that people ought to see, and he persuaded me as much as anybody else. And now, sadly, he's gone as well. He'll be buried on Friday. So there will be people from his family, I believe, at the Sheffield screening, and it does make it all very, very raw and present.
One of the characters talks about the death of his brother, which I suppose could be apt for Liam as well. And from him, the title of your film is taken: "Shed Your Tears and Walk Away." Is that what you've been doing?
Well, I felt as I heard that comment, I felt, yes, that's what I've always tried to do, and it's what I'd kind of decided wasn't working when Emma died, and I was profoundly upset. But also there was something unreal about him saying it, because as soon as he said it, he downed this can of Carlsberg Special Brew, and you just think, you clearly haven't walked away. You know, that clearly doesn't work. And very recently, Emma, whose death started it all, her sister went on one of the discussion groups for the town and said, you know, it's a thing for the town to not shed our tears and walk away, but to look at what's going on and engage with it. So I'm hoping that on those various levels that the title is saying something kind of useful or helpful.
I think it is. I think anyone that sees it at Sheffield on Saturday will certainly shed tears. But it lingers long, as you say, and I'm afraid that the story, the real life, goes on outside of it. Jez Lewis, thank you so much for coming to talk to us. I'm so sorry that you've got to go back to Hebden Bridge again for another funeral, but I wish you the best of luck with your film at Sheffield.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much for having me.
Shed Your Tears and Walk Away should be on the small or big screen by early next year, and it of course plays at Sheffield on Saturday. It's just one documentary in a very fine lineup at this year's festival. For more information, go immediately to its website, chefdocfest.com. Joining me to run down some of this week's releases is Guardian critic Zan Brooks. Zan will be reviewing this week the animated version of A Christmas Carol, Jennifer's Body, Bright Star, and a French film called Welcome. So welcome to you. Nice to have you back.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been roving around. Did you catch the end of the London Film Festival? Is that what you were doing?
I was mired up in Norwich giving some lectures to the kids.
Really? Yeah. Like Alan Partridge?
Yeah, exactly. It was very much an Alan Partridge experience.
Well, I'm glad they've got the benefit of your wisdom. Let's have some more wisdom from you. Let's talk about A Christmas Carol, animated by Robert Zemeckis, starring the voices of Jim Carrey, Gary Oldman, and Bob Hoskins. Here's Jim Carrey meeting the ghost of Christmas past.
You, the spirit whose coming was foretold to me? Is it possible that you wait? Put your cap on.
Would you so soon put out with your worldly hands the light?
No, 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 no! I'm so sorry! I meant nothing by it! I meant no offense! I just thought I... Who and what are you?
Lovely. A nice Irish accent from The Ghost of Christmas Past. Who knew that they came from County Donegal?
Yeah, this is one of the many liberties, I guess, or extrapolations that Robert Zemeckis takes with Dickens' tale. In fact, it's not even Dickens' tale anymore. This is Disney's A Christmas Carol.
Is that what it says on the front?
That's
the title. Say based on a book by Charles Dickens.
Yeah, but only very tangentially.
But it opens with a book. It's like that old Disney thing where they always have the book and it's like the weighty ledger opens to prove that this is literary based.
Yes, and then it goes off in its own direction. Yes. Which principally seems to be over the rooftops of snowy London.
Something like a snowy London.
Something like an approximation.
No kind of recognisable.
It's no recognisable. It's not the London that we live in, or our ancestors even.
There's no gherkin. I mean, I don't know what they're doing.
it's a sort of Disney theme park ride, this, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it, as such, it works fine. But I still found it a little bit irritating.
Why is that?
I don't know. I should know, shouldn't I?
Is it the stop motion? Is it the sort of animation?
Yeah, I don't like motion capture. I find it crude and synthetic.
It's a very odd sort of thing because I was thinking this. It stars Jim Carrey. It doesn't look like Jim Carrey, but it's probably acted by Jim Carrey. Mm. In fact, Bob Cratchit, played by Gary Oldman, sort of looks a bit like Gary Oldman. A bit, and they've obviously used him there. They have to do all the acting, do they? And they turn up and then they get animated on, so they just don't have to do costumes. I don't really know how it works or what it adds to anything.
I certainly don't know either of those things either. And I don't really think it does add anything to it. Of course, there's the initial thrill of seeing this new technology with all the bells and whistles.
Yeah.
But it soon starts to pull, and it actually does keep you at kind of arm's length from the actual story.
Mm.
And so I found that a bit annoying.
It is. We should add it is 3D, so you have to have the glasses,
3D
or we
too,
did anyway.
Right? Another
I'm sure
bit of
it
distance.
Exists.
Yeah, it does. It's going out in both formats.
I quite liked going inside it, and I quite liked the look of it, actually. And you say it's based on Disney, and it's based on Charles Dickens. I thought this was based on Alistair Sim's Christmas Carol, that 1951 version, that kind of classic. I mean, I thought Jim Carrey's characterisation was totally based on Alistair Sim.
Yeah.
And the rest of it, I still thought it was quite scary. I still thought the chain wrapping was good.
It's fairly scary for a kids' film. There's the bit where Marley's jaw falls off, which is straight out of an 18-cert horror film.
It was pretty good, that stuff. Yeah. And then he tries to put it back, so they make a bit of light of it, because it didn't happen. But, I mean, Michael Hordern, who plays Jacob Marley in that Christmas Carol to which I refer, he's pretty scary as well. And the sound design was always quite scary, especially on the crackly VHS that I've got of it, because it sounds like awful. And it also, I had trouble hearing it. I know that visually things have come on, but Dolby-wise, I don't think things have improved very much. I was like, what's he saying?
No, and it was kind of distorting, wasn't it? And sort of blasting. Yeah, blasting us, it was.
That said, I kind of, although I wasn't ready for Christmas at all, it's only early November, I thought it worked for a bit. I was quite charmed by it.
Really? I'm surprised that you were, because I was utterly uncharmed by it. I thought, you know, it's one of those films that for all of Dickens's faults, Christmas Carol is a human story. It might be a bit caricatured, you know, the Tiny Tim character might be a bit annoying, but it still is a story of a man's past and the compromises that he's made and how he's lost his direction. This didn't have any of that. This was a sort of thrill ride through lots of ghosts.
Yeah.
And it's a film that, you know, knows the cost of everything and the value of nothing, which is the great irony of Scrooge himself, but it doesn't seem as if Zemeckis has learned his lesson.
See, I think Zemeckis is terribly underrated by, again, I think you're underrating Zemeckis.
No, in his defence, I love Castaway.
Yeah, it's good.
I think Castaway is a
great
film.
American Fable. Mm. I think underrated. But I love Back to the Futures. Nah. Roger Rabbit. He does amazing things.
I don't like that either.
Yeah, see, I think he's kind of underrated. I think he's a pioneering director who's interested in various kind of issues in technology.
He's interesting
and
in technology,
futures.
Is what he's interested in.
Yeah, but going to the future and kind of dealing with time and past and all of those things, which he does in Castaway, which he does in Back to the Future, which he does again here, and I think he's kind of really, I mean, people don't respect him, I think, because he's not clearly an auteur of some great standing or doesn't have any huge theories. I think he's a very, very interesting worker in the genre. Now, this occurred to me during A Christmas Carol as they were going back to the future, if you like, to the right. Christmas present and Christmas future. And this kind of worked for me quite well, actually, I have to say. I was rather impressed by Carrie's performance. I quite liked the kind of style of it. And I thought it kind of captured the right... we're reading Dickens's book, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, I'm playing the role of Scrooge here.
No, quite right.
I've got to say bah humbug to you.
Yes.
I didn't like it.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, all of you. Dan, let's move on to Jennifer's Body. Diablo Cody, who won an Oscar writing Juno. Here she's writing again, starring the hottest girl on the planet, apparently, Megan Fox, and Amanda Seyfried, who was in the biggest film on the planet last year, Mamma Mia, directed by Karen Kusama. Jennifer's Body, it is hot, but it is also demonic.
Okay.
She's eating boys. They, like, make her really pretty and glowy, and her hair looks amazing. And then when she's hungry, she's weak and cranky and ugly. I mean, like, ugly for her. Don't you get it? The dance. It'll be like an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Zan, Karen Kusama did Girl Fight. She's a sort of feminist enterprise here, working with chicks, written by a chick, directed by a chick. Is it a better than a chick flick?
It's certainly an interesting twist on the chick flick genre. But I'd have to say that Karen Kusama is almost second billed here. This is a Diablo Cody film.
Yeah.
And that's quite an interesting twist, isn't it? Because I think probably only Charlie Kaufman out of the American writers are bigger than the director on a film. And this is being very much marketed as Diablo Cody's follow-up to Juno.
Yeah, absolutely. So are all her trademark smart-mouthed Americanos in there?
Yeah, it's got the arch, slangy dialogue. It's not remotely scary.
No.
But it's almost like a precocious undergraduate's thesis on the horror movie, pastiche of the horror movie.
But it seems to me that she doesn't even like horror movies or can't be asked to actually make a horror movie. So she's going to spoof it. But you have to at least have some grasp of the genre.
And some affection
for
it.
I didn't really know what this was about, this film.
I think it's about her.
I didn't understand it, though.
I think it's all about her.
About Diablo.
Well, it's all right. It's Megan Fox as the cheerleader, head cheerleader. Amanda Seyfried as her mousy, sort of deferential best friend. But then the Megan Fox character, Jennifer, falls in with a bad indie band who comes to town and gets transformed into a sort of demonic succubus.
Yeah, but how did that happen? I think I drifted off. Suddenly they were watching a band and then suddenly it all got on fire.
Would any explanation satisfy you average high schooler gets transformed into a demonic succubus?
You're right, I'm not watching enough Buffy.
And it goes from there. And then Amanda Seyfried suspects that Megan is now a demon. And rushes to protect the other students from her.
Because she's gobbling up all the boys.
She's gobbling up all the boys who can't believe their luck that they've got a date with Megan Fox.
None of it made any sense to me, I have to say. I didn't think it was funny or scary or particularly original. And I think Karen Kusama, your director friend there, gets kicked out of the way quite often. I think she tries to make kind of interesting feminist films. Aeon Flux she tried to make with Charlize Theron and Naomi Harris. Interesting sort of female superhero chick thing. And that got the studio obviously went, no, thanks, love, but we want to make some money here. No feminist theorising. And I think that the same happened here again. I mean, any interesting tropes were completely thrown out the window, like some high schooler's head ripped off by the fangs of Megan Fox.
Yeah, the problem I have with this is it's more a series of gestures and poses than an actual film. It's almost like it's been designed as a cult classic.
Let's move on to Bright Stars, Anne. Slightly more romantic vision of love from Jane Campion here, a film that was at Cannes. It has been at the London Film Festival, is now on general release. It stars Ben Whishaw as Keats, who's falling in love with his next-door neighbour, seamstress Fanny Braun, played by Abby Cornish.
Pillowed upon my fair love's ripening breast, to feel forever its soft swell and fall. Awake forever in a sweet unrest. Still, still to hear her tender taken breath.
It's new. From which poem?
Yours. Bright Star.
Ben Whishaw there, who does Keats in a kind of elegantly wasted kind of romantic poet way.
Well, he's almost like he's from an indie band, isn't he?
Yeah.
He has that sort of fey fragile. You imagine him in some little band singing.
With his little skinny wasteful things playing downtown.
So
he'd be very popular, wouldn't he?
I
like Ben Whishaw, I have to say.
I quite liked him, and I quite liked him in this, but I preferred Abby Cornish. I thought that she was utterly superb in the role of Fanny Braun. It's a performance of you know, great dignity and seriousness, I think. And she is the star of this film, really. She is the one who holds it all together.
Yeah, it's an interesting piece of work, this one, because I find it quite divisive, this one. I don't dislike it. I think Jane Campion is a very particular director who makes films about female sensuality from a female-y sensuous point of view that sometimes escapes me, and I feel bad that it escapes me.
I'm going to join the sorority of women on this film, because
you go,
I'm
Diablo.
Still in a swooning state about this,
yeah?
Too. I thought this was extremely good. I think it's confident, it's measured. I'm not normally a fan of the romantic period drama because I think that often they put the period details centre stage and that's the star. Whereas this, I believed in these two characters and the three characters as well, because there's a very interesting third wheel here played by the American actor Paul Schneider playing Mr. Brown, who is Keats's boorish best friend.
Scottish.
And I believed in all these people, and it was almost like a love story that just happened to be set in the past,
yeah.
As opposed to a film about the past and the heritage cinema and all that entails.
It doesn't get in the way, does it, the heritage stuff? I mean,
not at all.
It's kind of some muddy stuff and there's muddy skirts and stuff, but the houses, it's actually very believable, actually.
It's totally believable, and I like the sense of Hampstead as this sort of untamed, wild neighbourhood,
yeah.
Where you can see London in the distance over the hills and through the forest.
It is. They've got a McDonald's there now.
They have. It's a disgrace. Keats would be turning in his grave.
Wouldn't he just? Jane Campion's bright star, of which much has been said, I quite like Xan Likes a lot, and I think that's a good thing. I would go and see that one, definitely, because Bluebells look beautiful. So beautifully shot by Greg Fraser, who I think is a
wonderful score to it, too. I mean, the only slight problem I'd have with it is I think it gets a bit more conventional in the second half when Keats starts the kind of the
yes
the romantic coughing.
My problem is that there's no real drama in it. I mean, like, they're in love and then it's going to be a bit doomed because he goes to London without a coat.
Yes, and and who hasn't done that?
Do you see? It's cold out there. You're
We're
not even wearing a vest. I'm worried about you, Xan, too. Xan, let's move on to Welcome, which is another chilly dip in English weather, because it's about an Iraqi refugee in sort of Calais, Sangatte region who can't get on board a ship or a boat or a train. So he decides he's going to swim the channel to get to England.
You know that only good swimmers can cross the channel?
And the water is too cold and the current is too strong.
Why do you want so much to go there? She looks pretty.
Xan, the English Channel must be crowded with actors trying to swim the channel. David Walliams is still in there.
Yeah, they're all clawing at each other. They're going one way and going the other
way. Tilda Swinton from the Benjamin Button, her character, she swam the channel. Mm. Is it a cinematic device or does it work?
Well, it has to be said that it's the denouement of the film. The film isn't about... we're not talking about Chariots of Fire in the water here. It's more a film about the refugee camps,
yeah.
In Calais, and does have a real verite to that. It really does capture the huddled masses who are trying to...
The French loach is at work here.
Yeah, who are trying to kind of hop on the lorries or cling onto the trains. And Vincent Landon is fantastic as the sort of the gruff hangdog local swimming instructor who starts a sort of surrogate father-son relationship with this Kurdish teenager. And he knows that he's wanting to swim the channel, but he's sort of coaching him all the same in the local swimming baths. Swimming baths again in films this week.
Yep, you see, there's a lot of water about. Not any drop to drink. I didn't quite get Vincent Landon's sort of character conversion here into kind of sort of gruff swimming coach. Oh, I'm going to kind of father these kind of Kurdish refugees and
take
them
in. He's trying to impress his wife. He's got the obligatory woolly liberal wife who works in the soup kitchen, who he's getting divorced from, but this is his way of perhaps winning her back. So his motives are slightly compromised.
This was a big hit in France, this film. It sort of tapped into just about the right vein of liberalism for French.
I'm very
liberal
glad. It does paint the French authorities in a very bad light.
Doesn't
indeed.
It? Every policeman is a kind of, you know, thug.
Yeah, and the neighbours are all snitches. and, you know, it's a story of our times.
So, a bienvenue to Welcome. Xan, thank you very much indeed for your reviews this week. Lovely to see you again. Do catch all of Xan's musings on the world of film at the world's best film site, guardian.co.uk/film. New York's Tribeca Film Festival rose out of the dust of 9/11 as a defiant and positive artistic response by its founders, Robert De Niro being the most famous among them. but now the spirit and reputation of Tribeca have been taken up in the Arabian city of Doha in Qatar. Last weekend saw the first Doha Tribeca Film Festival, and Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps travelled forth to pick out some of the festival's highlights.
Well, I'm here on a very hot Doha night in the very brightly lit, very beautiful lit gardens of the Museum of Islamic Art, which stands fairly grandly just to the left of me. And just to the right is one of the two really enormous screens that have been erected here for the Doha Film Festival. A local rap band just worked up the audience and have got off stage. And I think the DJs are warming up behind me. Earlier, on the same screen, we had a screening of Cairo Time by a director called Ruba Nada and starring Patricia Clarkson, who most of you will know from her role in Vicky Cristina Barcelona, and the British actor Alexander Siddiq. Cairo Time is a very old-fashioned love story, and it's a love letter to the city of Cairo in many ways. It's quite beautifully shot. Alexander Siddiq plays the character of Tariq, who chaperones his friend's wife, Juliet, who's played by Patricia Clarkson, and, of course, Passions in Flame. The film not only screened twice here at the festival, it actually took the top prize, so it was a real hit with the locals. So I caught up with director Ruba Nada a little bit earlier to find out more about the film.
Reason for visit?
I'm here to see my husband.
It's Juliet.
I'm Tariq.
Unfortunately, your husband has been delayed in Gaza.
If there is anything you should need, please.
I'm going crazy. Men keep following me. Why is everyone staring?
You're a very beautiful woman.
It's been years since young men.
I find that hard to believe.
My name is Ruba Nada, and I'm the writer and director of Cairo Time. Cairo is such a... My first visit was when I was 17, and it left such a impression on me. The city was just so ancient and beautiful and chaotic and crazy, but just there's something gentle about it, and there's something about it that also kind of chips away at your guard. So I really wanted to... I had to come back and set a story in this beautiful city.
It's an extraordinarily sort of old-fashioned kind of film. It has at the center of it a love story that's not very common. It was that deliberate?
1,000%, yes. I remember editing my last movie and thinking, the problem with the West is that romance is dying. It's all about, you know, you go on a date and then, you know, you're expected. It's just everything's being speeded up now, I find, in the West, and I just wanted to make a movie that was romantic, not like a chick flick, not a romantic comedy. I just wanted to do something that was romantic. And I studied literature in university. I studied Jane Austen and the Brontes and Dickens, and so I have that in my blood, and I wanted to do something that was a throwback to that style.
Juliet's played by Patricia Clarkson, yeah, who's really an actress on the rise. Yeah. Had a fantastic role in Vicky Cristina Barcelona, yeah, recently with, yeah, Woody Allen. How did she come on board with the project? I mean, she was pretty ideal for the part.
Actually, Christine Vachon, icon of a producer, is my executive producer of Killer Films. And I remember we all had a meeting. We were all, you know, Christine is amazing. She's like, you know, who's your number one choice? And I said, well, Patricia Clarkson, because I needed someone who just with the flick of an eye could carry that emotion that I was looking for, that subtlety. And Christine was like, okay. And she sent the script to her agent, and the agent loved it. And before I knew it, I flew to New York and I met her, and we just bonded right away. She said yes to coming to Cairo, and it was amazing.
When you were shooting in Cairo, did you take her reaction and her sort of immediate spontaneous reaction to the city as a sort of a guide as you went through the actual shooting?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is that it's so funny. Even though I'm an Arab, I speak the language fluently. I've lived in Damascus. Even to this day, I land in Cairo and I'm like, oh my goodness, what am I doing here? How do I get out? Because it's such a crazy city. And so I've always approached it still as a tourist. With Patricia, she's a Southerner. She's a New Yorker. You know, but even her, she was just like, oh my goodness, we're in Oz. So I just, and she's such a stellar actress that all I would do is one take, and we'd get her honest reaction. I mean, it was a dream to see the pyramids, and she had her back towards them until that final shot where she saw them, and she was like, So yes, I did that.
Thanks for coming on Film Weekly, and good luck with the film, Ruben.
Thank you so much. You're so lovely. Thank you.
Well, one of the hits with the local expat Indian community here was director Dev Benegal's Road Movie. It's a hilarious and sometimes surreal take on the road movie genre. The film follows the character of Vishnu, a young man who takes to the road with his uncle's mobile cinema. He's off to sell it in a far-flung town. And of course, on the way we get lots of great scenery and a voyage of discovery for Vishnu. I managed to catch up with Dev Benegal after a fairly boisterous Q&A after the screening, just to find out a little bit more about what probably is the first Hindi road movie. First, Dev Benegal, welcome to Film Weekly. Is this the first Hindi road movie that's come to the screens?
Yes, the first Hindi film, which is a road movie, and it's about not just a journey on a road, but a journey on the road of a traveling cinema, an old truck with two 40-year-old Italian film projectors in the back, and which goes and shows movies out in the open air.
Of course, it obviously explicitly refers to the genre of the road movie, and it's infused with references to road movies in European cinema. I take it you're a huge fan of the road movie in the European sense.
I absolutely love the genre, and I think for a long time I wanted to write a road movie. I wanted to make a road movie. One, because I love watching road movies on screen, and there was this amazing film that I saw when I was still studying in school, which was a black and white film called Radio On. And I remember going to a festival and I saw this, and I was just completely blown away by this movie. And I said to myself, you know, if I can make a movie like that, I will just die happily. That is it. But more than that, there was also this tradition of, or this sort of phenomena of traveling cinemas, which exists as we speak. And a distributor friend of mine told me that 70% of Indians still watch movies in that form. And what's amazing about these traveling cinemas are they aren't allowed by law to screen in a city, in a small town, or even a village. So they have to go beyond into just a no man's land, into, you know, what the Australians might call the outback. And it's there that they kind of go and they steal electricity from some overhead high tension wire, and they spread out this big screen and they show films, and people will walk for days, hours and days to get there to come and watch a movie, and it's really like a pilgrimage.
Famous road movies tend to sort of signal a younger generation becoming aware of the world and trying to sort of throw off their parental bonds or the sort of strictures of the previous generation. That's very much, I think, at the heart of this story too. I mean, would you agree with that?
Well, it's an autocritique of my generation. It's really to begin with about how little I and my generation know about, you know, the countryside and what's happening beyond our little confined world. And so there was this, that was very, very clearly the idea of writing a story about a young man who is sort of really, in a sense, representative of the new Indian generation, and the road being really this kind of bridge between tradition and modernity, and the idea of him sort of questioning whether he should jettison the past in order to find the future.
And we're here obviously in Qatar and Doha, the inaugural festival. Have you enjoyed the audience's reaction to your films? You said that's your first visit to the region, and yet it's such a big part of the film world, Bollywood, here in the region.
Bollywood is really huge in this region, which I was aware of. So I was kind of coming in with my film with a fair amount of hesitation and trepidation, not sure what the response would be, but they all seem to really like the movie. They got the jokes, which is really important. Though a lot of them felt that it was only 89 minutes, and that was a big problem. It should have been longer.
Okay, well, maybe you can make a part two. Maybe there's a sequel in there. Dev Benegal, thanks a million for coming on Film Weekly. Enjoy the rest of the festival.
Thank you very much.
Well, a film that didn't pick up any awards here at the Doha Tribeca Film Festival, but definitely inspired and infused the local film students when I saw the director speak a little bit earlier at a masterclass, is The Time That Remains by director Elias Suleiman. The film's a visually arresting black comedy, which draws on Suleiman's family history in Nazareth, starting with the surrender of the town in 1948 to the Israeli army. The film straddles 60 years of his family history, drawn from diaries that his father left him, letters from family, local history in Nazareth, and of course Suleiman's Jacques Tati-esque imagination. I did manage to catch up with Elias Suleiman, but first let's just hear a clip from The Time That Remains.
شو جابك من بسال لهون؟ لما فاتوا على البلد صار حمل الناس بتركات وزيتوها على الحدود. جيت هربت تخبيت من البلد اللي حدنا. بعدين كل بلد صرت افوت لها لاقين صاروا داخلينها. بس ما كنتش متخيل لاقين صاروا واصلين لهون.
I'm here with Elias Suleiman. We've just come out of a very dynamic masterclass that you gave here at the festival. And you gave what I thought was the most blunt and open advice to the filmmakers, the young student filmmakers. You basically said, you are competition, I want to give you no advice, you should not make films and die. Of course you said it totally tongue-in-cheek, with a lot of black humour. Am I right to say that black humour is always at the tip of your tongue?
No, sometimes I lose my sense of humour and you should see that. No, and I didn't say that to the students, you're being so unfair. I think, but this is my opinion, that there is no way they're going to escape the difficulty in making films. But I will never exchange my being in cinema, I wouldn't say a filmmaker, but this experience of being there, being a filmmaker, I don't think I will exchange my body and soul for another experience.
Well, speaking of ecstasy and agony and risk, The Time That Remains is a semi-biographical film.
Absolutely.
It's a film that you draw on from your own history, your personal history, and also a film that, like so many of your other films, that you also perform in. Can you just tell me a little bit about how this film came about? I believe it had something to do, or in part to do, with the diaries of your father, or the memories of your father, and his role in the sort of rebellion.
Mm-hmm. I did think about this narrative of the 48 in particular for a long time. But I was so insecure, you know, and so insecure to adopt, you know, someone else's notes and diary. And so insecure because I knew that I will not entirely know or feel the camera position vis-a-vis those who are going to be in front of it because I have not lived this experience. Mm. I had the privilege, of course, of saying adopt, but it's my father who told me this story so many times. The other privilege is that all of what you saw is in my neighborhood. I did exactly also what an actor does when they go and you know, be who they want to be in a film and experience it in real life. It was very extensive, the research, very, very extensive. I put every segment.
You did a De Niro.
De Niro, right. He's here, by the way.
Yeah, he is here, yeah. The characters in the film, the men in particular, you find the boyishness and the playfulness in male characters.
You have to remember that I'm a filmmaker and I like to play. I like to be playful. And you see all my films, they're mostly a lot of my films, what instigates the moment is the moment of humor. I'm giggling every time there's a burlesque moment that I can achieve in my films. So, and Nazareth, it's a little bit like being in some poor neighborhood in Palermo, you know. There's a lot of mafioso-looking and acting men sitting around and doing nothing. And for me, that's a tease. There's something that is quite intriguing about this kind of deadpan face, you know. Maybe with a lot of inner violence, but without expression in the face. So it makes the image more charged with a lot of tension. And at the same time, if you put a little bit of humor, it breaks all that tension. Actually, some of them are my real old friends who were these people. So I'm still friends with a lot of them. And some of them, one of them, for example, who acted the policeman, I mean, this guy was laughing when I told him, you want to act a policeman? He said, me, a policeman? You're crazy. You know, he's like the most anti-police you can ever imagine. But he's like a major gangster. So, but it's part of the fun.
Also, that playfulness is indebted to some extent to the work of Jacques Tati. And you spoke about him briefly earlier.
I totally agree with you as far as the similarity. in terms of sensibility. But I mean, I've only started to watch Tati after Chronicle of a Disappearance. I didn't even know of his existence. I was not a francophone in cinematic terms at all. But it's true that when I watched Tati after I finished Chronicle, I was terribly shocked of even sometimes similar cinematic moments, you know. And this is absolutely true. Now, after having seen him, I am in total adoration. When I said in the masterclass today, you probably heard that for tenderness, I would just always escape to Primo Levi. And for lightness, Jacques Tati.
Elia, thank you so much. Thank you for the time that remains. It's an inspiring film. Good luck. We hope to see you in the UK pretty soon.
Thank you very much.
As you can hear, there's a fireworks celebration going on here. It's definitely going out with a bang, the festival. It's been a very interesting few days. It's been short, it's been sweet, it's been hot. And all in all, not a bad start to the Doha Tribeca Film Festival.
Safe to report, Jason Phipps made it back to produce this week's show, which sadly comes to an end right now. Do pick up a copy of this Sunday's Observer for my Trailer Trash column, of course. The music featured this week is from the beautiful soundtrack to Jane Campion's film, Bright Star. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my returned producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.